Lecture 4, Homeric Epic and the East-West Conflict.
Hello and welcome to lecture number 4. In this lecture, we're going to continue talking about the context of Herodotus's work and his achievement by discussing the two great Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and their influence on Herodotus's narrative method and his approach to his material. I'll start by giving a brief description of the Homeric epic's place in and importance to Greek literature, and then I'll synopsize the events of the Trojan War, which the Iliad and the Odyssey deal with, and we'll talk about the episodes in the Trojan War covered by each epic. Then we'll consider specific ways in which Herodotus's work was modeled on the Iliad and the Odyssey, most obviously in its subject matter, but also in Herodotus's use and presentation of characters and of speeches that he puts in the mouths of individual characters. And then finally, we'll look at some important differences between Herodotean and Homeric narrative. Now, the two great epics of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, are the first works of Greek literature. They're also the culmination of a centuries-long oral tradition. So they both stand as the end of oral tradition and at the beginning of the Greek literary tradition. They were written down probably sometime in the 8th century BCE, though we don't know exactly when or how or by whom these works came to be written down. They show unmistakable evidence of oral composition, both in their reference to actual cities of Mycenaean Greek culture hundreds of years before the time when the Iliad and the Odyssey were written down, also in their use of archaic linguistic forms, and in their verse composition and in various other ways. They are unmistakably products of oral composition and oral tradition. And the discovery of this, the demonstration of the Iliad and the Odyssey's essentially oral nature, was one of the great scholarly achievements of the 20th century in the field of classical studies. But obviously, at some point, they were written down, since after all, we have them now as written texts. We don't know exactly when that occurred. We do know that the epics probably developed for several centuries before assuming their final form in which we now have them, their final written form. The influence of the Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, on later Greek literature and society is incalculable. It's impossible to overstate how important Homer was for Greek culture, for later Greek literature, for Greek society in general. The epics served as an almost inexhaustible fund of characters, of storylines drawn on by authors in other genres such as tragedians, comedians, lyric poets, historians like Herodotus. They were an inexhaustible wellspring of storylines, of characters, of episodes that other authors could work with. They also served as sources of quotations, as reference points, so to speak, for any discussion that two people might be engaged in. For instance, in Plato's dialogues, very frequently one character, Socrates or someone else, will quote Homer almost as a way of clinching an argument, as a way of backing up what he's saying by putting in a particularly appropriate quotation from either the Iliad or the Odyssey. For Herodotus, the Homeric epics suggested the subject matter of his work and even, I think, the structure of his work in ways that I'll talk about in the later part of this lecture. Now, the subject matter of the Iliad and the Odyssey is located firmly in the heroic age, that age that I was talking about in the previous lecture that corresponds more or less with actual Mycenaean Greek culture. Both the Iliad and the Odyssey deal with events that took place during or immediately after the Trojan War. And the Trojan War is the most famous episode of classical myth and also the event that closes out or that finishes the heroic age. For Herodotus and his contemporaries, the Trojan War marked the end of the heroic age and the beginning of what we would call purely human history. Of course, Herodotus wouldn't use those terms since, as we've talked about before, history is an anachronistic term and he didn't have a word to indicate precisely that. But the Trojan War was seen as the last episode of the heroic age, the last time when the great heroes interacted with one another and interacted with the gods. So the Trojan War was, in effect, what could be called a liminal event. It looked back to myth, back to the heroic age, but forward into the human present. And it did that particularly through the position of the heroes of myth, the heroes of the Iliad and the Odyssey, serving as ancestors of modern Greek families. So there's a connection with the heroic age through the heroes as ancestors, and yet there's also the sense, as I discussed about myth in general, that things in the remote past, in this case in the heroic age, were very different, that the world no longer operates quite as it did then. This liminal nature of the Trojan War is part of the reason for its importance in Greek thought, culture, and literature, that it does mark that kind of dividing line between the previous time of heroes and of gods interacting freely with humans, the later time when things don't work the same way anymore, and when humans and gods are more divided than they were during the Trojan War and the period before it. Now, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the two great Homeric epics, narrate only part of the story of the Trojan War. This often surprises people who haven't read them. People assume that the Iliad tells the whole story of the Trojan War, or at least tells the story of the end of the Trojan War, with the Trojan horse and the Greeks bursting out of it at night and overcoming the Trojans and so forth. But it doesn't. The Iliad focuses on events that happened in the last year of the Trojan War, but not following up to the end of the war. It culminates in the death of the Trojan prince Hector. The Odyssey deals with mainly with the adventures of the Greek hero Odysseus on his way home after the Trojan War. These two epics weren't the only ones in antiquity that dealt with the Trojan War. There were other epics, now lost, other epics that no longer exist, that filled in the rest of the story, that told the episodes that the Iliad and the Odyssey don't narrate but only allude to. Now, I always want to add, when I say that there were other epics that were now lost, the Iliad and the Odyssey were recognized in antiquity as out and away the two greatest epics. So when I say that there were several others that don't exist any longer, I'm not implying that we have lost 8 or 10 other Iliads and Odysseys. We haven't. It's still a great loss. We would still like to have the narration of the rest of the Trojan War story in epic form, but the Iliad and the Odyssey were recognized even in antiquity as out and away the two greatest epics among what was called the epic cycle. Herodotus undoubtedly knew these other epic poems, the ones that are now lost, and he certainly was very familiar with the overall story of the Trojan War. We, modern students of the ancient world, are in the very odd position of recognizing the Trojan War as one of the most important episodes of classical myth, and yet not having any major work of ancient literature that tells the whole story of the Trojan War. We can piece it together, luckily. There are enough references scattered out throughout ancient literature that we can piece together the narrative of what happened in the Trojan War, and therefore we, like Homer's original listeners, can understand the context of both the Iliad and the Odyssey. But we don't have any one work of ancient literature that tells the entire Trojan War story. The story, as we can put it together from what we do have, however, goes as follows. The Trojan War, the war between the combined forces of Greece and the city of Troy, located in Asia Minor, was motivated by the abduction of a Greek queen by a Trojan prince. The Greek queen in question was, of course, Helen, the most beautiful woman in the world, who was the daughter of the god Zeus and the wife of Menelaus, king of Sparta. She was either abducted or seduced, depending on which ancient authority you ask, by Paris, prince of Troy. Paris is also known as Alexander, by the way, and Herodotus tends to refer to him as Alexander. She may have been kidnapped, according to some authorities. According to others, she went of her own free will with Paris. But whether she was abducted or whether she ran away with Paris, either way, Paris took Helen to Troy, and this was the motivating factor behind the Trojan War. Now, Paris was acting with the approval of the goddess Aphrodite, goddess of sexual passion and attraction, because he had awarded Aphrodite the prize in a beauty contest held among Aphrodite, Hera, and Athena. Those three goddesses each claimed to be the most beautiful of goddesses. Paris was chosen to judge the contest, and each goddess offered him a bribe if he would pick her as the most beautiful. The bribe Aphrodite offered was the most beautiful woman in the world as Paris's wife. That's the bribe Paris chose. The most beautiful woman was Helen. So despite the fact that Helen was already married, Paris was acting with the approval of the goddess Aphrodite in taking her back to Troy with him. And this decision of Paris that Aphrodite is the most beautiful of the three goddesses is usually referred to as the judgment of Paris. Under the command of Menelaus's elder brother Agamemnon, Menelaus, of course, was Helen's Greek husband, the Greeks mustered an army to go to Troy and fight for Helen's return. And the Trojan War lasted for 10, full years, with the fighting evenly balanced on both sides during most of that time. The Greeks would win some skirmishes, the Trojans would win others, but for most of the 10 years, the fighting was fairly equally balanced. Each side had one foremost warrior. The greatest Trojan warrior was Hector, Paris's older brother. The greatest Greek warrior was Achilles. Eventually, Achilles killed Hector, and the Iliad narrates the circumstances of Hector's death and ends with Hector's funeral. Later, in events that happen after the close of the Iliad, Paris killed Achilles. And finally, after 10 long years of war, the Greeks won, not through fair fighting, but through trickery. They used the famous ruse of the Trojan horse, which was invented by Odysseus, the hero of the Odyssey, to gain entrance into the city of Troy at night, and then come out of the Trojan horse while the Trojans were sleeping, sack and destroy the city, and thereby win the war. During the sack of Troy, the Greeks committed a great many outrages, acts that they should not have committed against the Trojans. And because of this, they suffered hardships on the way home. Just to give two quick examples, Agamemnon arrived back home only to be murdered by his wife and her lover. Odysseus spent 10 years wandering, trying to get back home to his island of Ithaca, and therefore, by the time he did arrive home again, he had been gone for 20 full years. One more example, Menelaus and Helen were blown off course and spent 7 years in Egypt before they made it back home to Greece. So the Trojan War is a primary episode of Greek myth. The Homeric epics are the main literary artifacts that deal with the Trojan War, and the Homeric epics served as models for Herodotus' histories in several very important ways. Most obviously, the subject matter of the epics and the histories is closely related. Like Homer, Herodotus takes a war between Greeks and Asians, Greeks and Easterners, as his main subject matter. The main focus of the Iliad is the Trojan War, or episodes in the Trojan War. The main focus of Herodotus' histories is the war between Persia and Greece. In the histories, as in the Iliad, the Greek army is a collection of troops from independent city-states, each with its own commander, and tensions at times can run high between different Greek groups. One of the motivating forces of the Iliad, one of the things that gets the storyline of the Iliad going, of course, as anyone who's read it will remember, is the quarrel between Agamemnon and Achilles. Agamemnon is the commander-in-chief of the Greek troops in the Trojan War, but his command is not always accepted easily or readily by some of his comrades. And we'll see later on in the course that there is a definite parallel with the struggles for command and the struggles for ascendancy during the Persian Wars between various different Greek groups. In Herodotus, as in Homer, the enemy is an Eastern empire headed by an extremely wealthy ruler. Priam in the Iliad, first Darius in the invasion of 490 BCE for Herodotus, then Darius' son Xerxes in the invasion of 480 BCE. And like Homer's Odysseus, so far I've been talking about parallels with the Iliad, but there are parallels with the Odyssey as well. Like Homer's Odysseus, Herodotus recounts the customs and the accomplishments of foreign peoples in strange lands. In fact, there is, I think, even a verbal echo of the Odyssey very near the beginning of Herodotus' histories. Herodotus says, as he's moving from his opening sentence through a prologue in which he talks about abductions of women in the mythic past, and then moving into the subject matter proper of the histories, Herodotus says that he will talk about small and great cities of men alike. And he says he knows that cities that are now great were small in the past and vice versa, so he'll mention both alike as he goes along. The phrase that he uses, small and great cities of men alike, he could have just said cities. He doesn't need to say cities of men. The phrase he uses is asteia anthropon, and that seems to be a direct verbal echo of line 3 of the Odyssey, where it says that Odysseus saw many cities of men and learned their minds, polad anthropon weden asteia kainoon egno. So asteia anthropon appears in line 3 of the Odyssey and is echoed by Herodotus near the beginning of his work. So Herodotus models his work to some extent, or its subject matter is modeled to some extent on the subject matter of both the Iliad and the Odyssey. Now obviously, Herodotus did not create the Persian Wars. To some extent, the parallels I've just pointed out were givens and perhaps suggested in part the idea of writing, the project of writing to him, because of the parallels between the situation of the Trojan War, the Eastern potentate, the unified Greek forces, all of those things. The similarities to the Odyssey seem to be more a matter of Herodotus' own control and choice. His decision to include descriptions of foreign peoples and strange lands is very reminiscent of the Odyssey. Whether that was intentionally in Herodotus' mind or not, of course, we cannot know. Less obviously than content, Herodotus' narrative is similar to Homer's in organization and in style. Herodotus focuses on the deeds of great men, their individual decisions, their actions, their errors, their triumphs. And I say men because it almost always is men. There are important women in Herodotus, but for the most part, he discusses the actions of men, what men did when they came into conflict with one another. Unlike later historians, Herodotus assumes throughout his work that the great deeds that he wants to talk about, the erga megala takai thomasta that he takes as his subject matter, are traceable to individuals' actions, to individuals' motivations, to individuals' desires, not to broad political or economic movements. And this is a point to which we will return several times in these lectures. I'll point that out over and over again when a particular episode in Herodotus is attributed to an individual's desires or an individual's decisions, rather than to the kind of causation that a modern historian might give of much broader political or economic factors. This is very Homeric. As I just said about the Trojan War, the Trojan War is motivated in Homer and in Greek myth in general, not by, say, a quarrel over shipping rights into the Black Sea, which is the kind of causation that a modern historian would probably give, but over a quarrel about who has the right to be married to Helen, over individual desires, individual actions, individual desire for revenge. So Herodotus's attribution of historical causation to the actions and desires of individuals is very Homeric, and also obviously is influenced by oral tradition and oral narrative as well. Another way in which he owes quite a debt to Homer is that his presentation of these men's actions includes speeches placed in individuals' mouths. Now, that is not an obvious way to write history. If you read a modern work of history, you're probably not going to find that most or a great proportion of the narrative is carried along by speeches quoted directly of what people said to one another on the battlefield, in the council room, or in any other such way. There may be quotations, yes, of particularly important speeches, but the narrative is not going to be carried first and foremost by speeches attributed to individuals. But in Homeric epic, the speeches are an extremely important part of the narrative. The Homeric bard, the narrator, does certainly narrate the storyline himself, and he does speak in the third person. Then Achilles did this, then Agamemnon did that. But a very large proportion of Homeric epic is directly reported speech, Achilles speaking to Agamemnon, Agamemnon responding to Achilles. The speeches in the Iliad and the Odyssey are so important and so memorable, in fact, that one theory about the origin of tragedy holds that tragedy developed when the recitation of Homeric epic was divided between two or more bards, one of them taking the narrator's role and another one reciting the speeches, i.e. playing the characters of Achilles, Agamemnon, and so forth. Herodotus's speeches are very reminiscent of this Homeric technique. And one point that I think is easy to overlook, but very much worth thinking about, is that Herodotus reports these speeches without explanation of how he could know what people had said to one another decades in the past and in another language. We'll see several instances of this when he reports what, for instance, the Athenian sage Solon and the Lydian king Croesus said to one another in or around 560 BCE. How could he know? He wasn't there. How could he know what these people had said to one another? He doesn't tell us. He doesn't give us any explanation. I think the attribution of speeches to his characters feels and seems so natural because of the Homeric model that it's easy just to gloss over the fact that he can't have known what people said to one another. He must be making it up. In this, though not, as we'll see in a minute, in very important other ways, in this, Herodotus resembles the omniscient narrator of Homeric epic. He presents himself to us as someone who just knows what these characters said and very much disinvites us to ask, how could he possibly know that? So the similarities between Herodotus' undertaking and its epic predecessor are obviously very important, but there were also key differences, and I want to turn to those at this point. One of the most important differences between epic and Herodotus' narrative is also one of the most obvious, that Herodotus writes in prose, not in verse. The histories are not cast in verse. They're not in dactylic hexameter, the verse meter of epic. They're written in prose. Now, I find when I teach Herodotus in the classroom that modern students almost invariably assume that prose is the natural, normal, primitive, if you will, form of writing, and that poetry, verse, is a highly developed, highly sophisticated, elaborated form of composition that only comes about once a culture is very highly literate. So they assume that early in a culture's development of literacy, and certainly before the development of literacy, they assume that prose comes first and that poetry is an artifact of highly refined literary sensibility. In fact, the opposite seems more likely to be true, at least in ancient Greek culture. Before the advent of writing, Greek society's traditions and cultural beliefs were cast in verse for ease of memory. The Homeric epics are in verse not because they are a highly elaborated artifact of an extremely advanced literate society, but because they are exactly the opposite, the artifact of an oral society. When material must be remembered without the aid of writing, it tends to be put into rhythmic verse to make it more memorable. And anyone who has ever tried to memorize a passage of prose as opposed to a passage of verse will know what I'm talking about. If you haven't ever tried it, I invite you to take tomorrow morning's newspaper, pick an article at random, and try to memorize it. It's almost impossible to do because there are no patterns. There's nothing to tell you what word is likely to come after another word. There's nothing to help you along. And yet I think almost all of us have had the experience of finding that we have memorized the words to, say, a song, even when we never intended to, because the melody, but more than just the melody, the rhythm, the verse of the song locks itself into our memories even when we aren't trying to memorize. So prose definitely mirrors ordinary conversation. Obviously, people don't normally speak in meter. But writing in prose is not the most obvious and immediate thing to do. Prose depends on writing to record it. It doesn't develop in an oral culture, since it is by its very nature less memorizable than highly structured verse. Now, Herodotus was not the first Greek writer to use prose. Its growing use mirrored Greek society's move away from oral composition towards written composition. Herodotus clearly could not have composed or organized the vast work that he produced without the use of writing. We don't know exactly how he gathered his data. We don't know exactly how he kept track of all the information he had gathered before he wrote it up. We don't know what his process was. But it's quite clear that Herodotus could not have written the work he did, could not have composed the work he did without writing. So in that regard, his use of prose is only one element of his move away from oral towards written composition. But as I've mentioned before, though his work was composed in writing, it was almost certainly published through oral performance. And in that regard, perhaps the prose choice rather than poetry is a little surprising, since most orally performed works would have been in verse, and that might be what an audience was expecting to hear when Herodotus performed his work. So one important difference between Herodotus and Homer is that Herodotus uses prose. Another important difference between Herodotus's work and the Homeric epics is that Herodotus does not normally assume the role of omniscient narrator. Now, the speeches are an exception to this general rule, and that's why I pointed the speeches out already, because there he does almost seem to act as though he's the omniscient Homeric bard. But for the most part, he does not present himself as omniscient. He does not even, very frequently, make the choice between variant traditions. He lets us do that. Herodotus is quite good about reporting his sources and reporting when his sources tell him different things. Over and over again, he will give us variant traditions. He will say, I have heard this story about what happened next. I have heard this story about it. I've heard yet another story about it. Sometimes he'll tell us which one he thinks is more likely to be true. Other times he won't give his own opinion. He'll simply leave it open for us to judge on our own which one is most likely to be true. Occasionally he'll give us one story, mention that he knows other variations, but not tell us what they are. So for instance, when he narrates the birth story of Cyrus the Great, king of Persia, he tells us one story and he says in passing, and I know three other accounts of Cyrus's birth as well. there are several instances when he reports something that he himself finds incredible. And I think these are very, very important for our evaluation of Herodotus as what is often called an honest reporter. There are times when he tells us something and he will say, some people say this, but to me they're saying something that's unbelievable. Or I think this is nonsense, but this is what they say. Or this cannot possibly be true, but here it is. And it's his willingness to report things that he thinks must not be true that I think is our best indication of his attempt to say what was told to him, of his attempt to present the information that he has gathered in a straightforward manner and let us make up our own minds about whether or not it is believable. Now, of course, there's an objection that can be made here. We don't know how many sources he chooses not to mention. We only know the times when he does mention variant traditions, times when he has sorted through them and has decided to leave some out. By definition, we can't know how often he's done that, but at least a good part of the time, Herodotus tells us what his sources are, tells us when he knows variant versions, and lets us decide which are more likely to be true. Perhaps the most important difference in Herodotus' stance as narrator and Homer's is that Herodotus does not and cannot report what the gods say to one another on Olympus. Anyone who has ever read the Iliad or the Odyssey will remember that one of the most characteristic elements of those works is the reported conversation between gods. Homer will take us to Mount Olympus and let us hear Zeus and Hera having a spat with one another. He'll show us Athena asking Zeus if it isn't about time to let Odysseus come home now. He'll even tell us what a god is thinking. When Poseidon sees Odysseus crossing the sea, he thinks to himself, well, I can't stop him from reaching the end of his journey, but at least I can give him some more trouble first, and he wrecks Odysseus's raft. So Homer has no problem with, in effect, taking us behind the scenes of the universe, telling us what the gods are doing, what they're thinking, what they're saying to one another. Homer can do that in his role as omniscient narrator of epic because we accept that as part of the convention. If we need a let-out clause, we can say it's because the bard of epic is inspired by the muse of epic poetry. She's a goddess, so she knows what other goddesses are up to, and she tells the poet. Although I doubt that most people ever thought that let-out clause through so carefully, it's simply part of the convention. The bard knows what gods as well as humans say to one another. Herodotus does not adopt that stance of knowing what the gods are saying to one another. When a god speaks in Herodotus, he speaks through the mouthpiece of an oracle. So Herodotus does at times tell us what, for instance, Apollo said. But he tells us what Apollo said by reporting to us a Delphic oracle, by reporting to us what Apollo's priest has said. Apollo does not speak himself in the histories, nor are the gods characters in Herodotus' histories. Now, Herodotus by no means dispenses with the gods or leaves the divine element out of his work. He mentions gods frequently, and he cites them as causes for events. And in fact, in Lecture 21, we'll devote a whole lecture to talking about Herodotus' treatment of the gods, the divine, supernatural in general. But when Herodotus cites a god or the divine as the cause of an event, he normally includes a human cause or agent as well. Once again, his focus is on human actions and human responsibility, not on divine actions and on divine causation. And as a reporter of human events, basing his report on what other people have said to him, what he's heard through Alcoe, what he's observed through Opsis, he does not presume to present himself as the omniscient narrator, and he doesn't presume to tell us what the gods are thinking, saying, or doing on Mount Olympus. All of these differences between Herodotean and Homeric narrative point to Herodotus's position as an heir of the Ionian Enlightenment, which sought for causes and discernible laws in the workings of the universe, and they point also to his familiarity with the great intellectual movements of Athens in the 5th century BCE. In the next lecture, we'll turn to discussing the Ionian Enlightenment and its influence on Herodotus' work.